Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's, I guess, official here. From the wire services, as we like to say, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton stunned voters at a town hall meeting in Erie, Pennsylvania today by telling them she was prepared to stay in the nomination fight for an additional century. How much longer will I stay in this race? She responded to a voter's question. 50 years? How about 100 years? When asked to clarify, Senator Clinton replied, I'll stay in this race for 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000 years. Senator Clinton added that she was refusing to announce an exit strategy from the race because that would send the wrong message to the enemy. New York Senator's comments echoed a strategy outline in a recently leaked internal campaign memo, which calls for her to remain in the race long after the Democratic National Convention, even if Senator Barack Obama becomes the official party nominee. According to the memo, Senator Clinton plans to follow Senator Obama's campaign bus around in a Chevy Suburban in the hopes of running it off the road. If necessary, we will sideswipe or ram into his bus, the memo said. Just really mess him up. For her part, Senator Clinton remained resolute at the town hall meeting, responding to a question about the recent surge in negative attacks. Her campaign is lobbed in Senator Obama's direction. What can I tell you? The surge is working. Well, with a tip of the hat on April Fool's Day, to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Today, on a more serious note, today is the day that if you want to hire cheap foreign labor inside the United States, if you want to hire an engineer from India to do the job that an engineer from America would do but would charge you more, today is the day that you have to make your application for what are known as H-1B visas. Now, the nature of these visas, and by the way, last year, the application period. Now, it used to be that, you know, they would open this application period on April 1st and it would stay open for months, maybe for the entire year. Last year, all of them were gone within the first day. In all probability, today they will all be gone within the first few hours, and the window will close because there's 65,000 of these things that they're giving out, and there's heavy lobbying from a variety of industries, but in particular from the IT industry. To increase that number. In 1998, I was CEO of an ad agency in Atlanta, Chandler McDonald Stout Schneiderman & Poe, Inc., DBA, the Newsletter Factory. And we were doing a newsletter for a multinational corporation, and they needed it done. This was an internal publication, actually, an internal communication to their employees. They needed it done in Spanish, English, and Japanese. An odd combination, but that's what they needed. And we, you know, just for the hell of it, we placed an ad in the Atlanta Constitution Journal, a help wanted ad, saying that we were looking for somebody who had a graphic arts background and who was fluent in Spanish, English, and Japanese. And a guy answered the ad. I'm not going to mention his last name on the air, but his first name was Shin. He was, we called him Shinji. He was born in Japan. His parents, when he was 5 or 6, moved to Peru, and he grew up in Peru until he was around 13 or 14, although he went to English language schools, and then he and his parents moved to the United States when he was a teenager. And he was fluent in Japanese, in Spanish, and English. I mean, absolutely fluent, as if he was a native speaker in all three languages. And he was here in the United States, and in order to work, he had to get an H-1B visa. And so I, as the employer, had to go down to the INS with Shinji, and I had to fill out all these forms, and I had to swear under oath that I could not find an American who could do this, and I really couldn't. And this is my one experience with these visas and with the INS. Well, actually, I've had another one. My sister-in-law is trying to become a U.S. citizen right now, and we're having to, you know, I mean, she's like 5 years into the process. You know, say, yes, she actually is living with my brother-in-law, and they do, you know, they're in love and they're married and all, quack, quack, quack. But in any case, so we got, finally, they approved it. And Shin worked for us for a couple of years, and he was a great employee and a very good graphic artist. That's how it used to be. It used to be that if you really and truly, if you had some eccentric need, I mean, that's what these things were put in place for. If you have some really strange need that you can't find an American who can do it, then, okay, fine. But what has happened instead is that Companies are basically using H-1B visas as a way of importing cheap labor. And the problem that comes along with this is the problem that it is said that we're not graduating enough college graduates, right? We're not, you know, anybody who's in the IT business knows that that's nonsense. But Bill Clinton was in town, and I'm not changing topics here. This is all part of one giant thread. Bill Clinton was in town yesterday, and Steve Dean, who's a local columnist with the Oregonian, a really great guy, went to the speech, and he talked about Bill Clinton. He said he spent 50 minutes making the connection between the two. This would be healthcare and education. And 50 minutes with barely a glance at his notes. He says, Clinton said, noting that adjusted for inflation, the median family income is $1,000 lower than when I left office, sending another 5 million families below the poverty line. He said, I'm quoting Steve Dean. He said, you can't bring, and he's quoting Bill Clinton, you can't bring the American economy back without creating new jobs. And you can't generate health care reform without replenishing an educated workforce and restructuring a system in which 30 cents of every health care dollar is spent on paperwork. We need a president who understands this, said Clinton. You know, clearly taking a pot shot, I think, and Steve Dean thought, at both George W. Bush and John McCain. Now, if you look at where, and so here's Bill Clinton saying we need to look at education. And we do need to look at education. In India right now, there are 229 universities, 8,000 colleges, 6.9 million students. India's system of higher education is the second largest in the world. And who pays for it? To finance higher education expansion. This is from the University of Buffalo. To finance higher education expansion, the government of India has consistently increased its share in the total expenditure on higher education from 49.1% in 1950 to more than 90% in 1999. Students pay a nominal fee that constitutes 10 to 15% of the budget of the institution. Several universities offer fee waivers to women students. So basically, you can go to college for almost nothing in India. Whereas in the United States, again, quoting the same organization, not only are the underlying per student costs high, but they are also higher than other countries. And, you know, in fact, very high. You look at total costs borne by students and families in U.S. colleges and universities is the year 2000. And public institutions, $15,900. And private colleges, $24,000 to $34,300. So who's coming in on these H-1B visas? These people who are trained in India. Well, interestingly, Infosys Technologies, which, by the way, is headquartered in Bangalore, India. Infosys is not a U.S. corporation. I mean, they probably have a U.S. division, but it is a multinational corporation headquartered in Bangalore, India. They have the most H-1B visas, 4,559. This is last year. Wipro has the second most, 2,567. They're also headquartered in Bangalore, India. The third company that has H-1B visas in the United States, Satyam Computer Services Limited, 1,396. They're also headquartered in India, in Hyderabad. And then you have a company based out of New Jersey and a company based out of Washington. That would be Microsoft with 959. And then we go back to India again. Tata Consultancy Services with 797. Patni Computer Services out of Mumbai, 477, and on it goes. All these Indian companies operating in the United States, bringing in labor from primarily India to basically the net effect of this is to be driving down the cost of labor, as it were, in the United States. And this is not going without notice. In Europe, where you can go to college for free in pretty much any country in Europe, at least in Western Europe, assuming that, you know, you have the competence to get into college, the Independent, the British newspaper, one of the large, substantial, well-thought-of independent, you know, well, it's called the Independent, national newspapers in Great Britain. The headline, USA 2008, the Great Depression. And David Osborne in New York writing for the Independent. We knew things were bad on Wall Street, but on Main Street it may be worse. 28 million people in the U.S. will be using government food stamps to buy essential groceries, the highest level since the food assistance program was introduced in the 1960s. And then he goes on, he talks about how in Michigan, 1 in 8 residents is on food stamp, double the level of 2000, the year that George Bush came into office, or the year that George Bush was appointed by the Supreme Court. Yeah, it was in November that it happened, in late November. The trend is not restricted to the Rust Belt regions. They note 40 states are reporting increases in applications for food stamps. 6 states, including Florida, Arizona, and Maryland, have had a 10% increase just in the last year. So here we have poverty increasing in the United States because wages are falling. Wages falling because it's harder and harder to get an education. You've got people dropping out of school in high school. A huge dropout problem in high schools in the United States. Why? Because they realize, many of these kids realize, in high school they figure it out, there's no way they're ever going to be able to afford to go to college. So without that, why bother? 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bring this all together, and I mean, there are so many pieces here that you can tie together. Here you've got John McCain out there re-embracing supply-side economics, saying, yeah, I'm a supply-sider. He's going back to the insanity of the Reagan administration and the insanity of the Bush administration, just his general insanity. At the same time that the economy is going in the tank, at the same time that the independent is declaring in the United Kingdom that the U.S. is entering another Great Depression, at the same time that many Americans feel that way, and we're asking the question, why do we have to import educated foreign workers instead of educating Americans? I mean, this doesn't seem like rocket science. We don't have enough doctors. Let's educate more doctors. You don't have enough nurses. Let's educate more nurses. Don't have enough engineers. Let's educate more engineers. This is investing in the infrastructure, the intellectual infrastructure, the human infrastructure of America. We are not only the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a national health care system. We are pretty much the only fully industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a fairly comprehensive higher education program where anybody who has the competence to get into college can do so and graduate without being tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And, you know, thus the insanity of it. So Jeb Bush has come up with a solution to the problem. And this is truly, truly strange. I mean, this is truly strange. Carl Hiaasen writing about this in the Miami Herald. He says, the panel of wizards assigned to fix Florida's gross tax inequities has impulsively broadened its scope to a social issue in which its expertise is even more dubious. What they want to do is erase from the Constitution, quoting Carl Hiaasen here, erase from the Constitution, one of my favorite authors, by the way, a long-standing ban on subsidizing religious institutions with public dollars. If the measure passes, Florida would be the first state in the country, Hiaasen writes, to formally trash the concept that the roles of church and government should be separated. The unseen hand behind this crusade belongs to former Governor Jeb Bush. And what's the bottom line here? Well, if you're not doing well in your school or your school's not doing well, then the government will pay for you to go to a school where they will teach you things like creation science and biblical history, religious doctrine. They're proposing to actually change the Constitution and certainly the laws of the state of Florida to do away with the separation of church and state. So, yeah, gee, that's a great way to solve the problem of not enough educated engineers. Let's just have the government pay for religious education. As proposed, Carl Hiaasen writes, the amendment would strip away the state's no aid language, that's no aid to religion, and replace it with this, quote, individuals or entities may not be barred from participating in public programs because of religion, end quote. Translation, as Carl Hiaasen writes, rush out and start your own church as soon as possible because deals are waiting in Tallahassee. And it's true. I mean, that's what Jeb Bush is proposing. Now, back in February 21st, 1811, it's before the War of 1812, James Madison, fourth president of the United States, James Madison exercised his first veto. What was it? It was a veto against a bill passed by Congress to give money to a local church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor, to provide housing and food for the poor. And he said this would establish a legal agency, which is the language they used back then for a legal precedent, that would break down the wall of separation between church and state. He said, and this is from his veto message, in 1811, fourth president of the United States, the author of the Constitution, James Madison, he said, because the bill vests and said incorporating church, in other words, because the bill gives to the church the authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, and this is education as well. Madison said, this would be a precedent for giving to religious societies as such a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. In other words, the federal government has no business giving money to churches. But they want to do that in Florida, and they say, well, that's going to solve our problem. Come on, solving these problems. We have a war economy that is killing us off. I mean, this as Dwight Eisenhower said it best. Let me just, this Dwight Eisenhower in 1953.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists,
bingo,
the hopes of its children.
Bingo, bingo.
The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities.
30 city schools.
It is. Two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population.
That's one bomber.
It is. Two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. The liberal Republican Dwight Eisenhower is president of the United States. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's only been the last 30 years. It's been since Reagan came along and drove this country nuts. When we adopted this neo-Friedmanism, this Friedrich von Hayek nonsense, this general Atlas Shrugged insanity of, I got mine and that's it. Greed is good. And the more greed you got, the better it is, because everybody pursuing their own enlightened self-interest will create a society that works for everybody. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. We are a nation of barn builders. We help each other out. We're not a nation of individuals who somehow carved a living out of the American Indian, right? I mean, to paraphrase the Firesign Theater, their joke on Out of the American Wilderness, but I mean, that's really what it is. This nation, and frankly, the nations of the people who occupied most of this land before Europeans came here, in all cases, you look back at the history of civilization and culture, it is people pulling together. It's not people putting on a coonskin cap and going off in the world. I mean, even to do that, you have to have a public education, and you have to have things that are made by groups of people working together. Franklin Roosevelt saw a mess and said, I'm going to do something about it.
I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And he fixed the problem. John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, John?
I'm doing good. I just wanted to contribute to your thread of thought there in that when you have this high dropout rate of American students, where do they go? And one of the places we've made room for them in California is expanding our incarceration facilities.
And this is how perverse the system is, John.
Totally perverse.
Well, let me take it even beyond that. There's not a lot of money that's made in education in the United States. Most educational institutions are not-for-profit organizations. But the fastest-growing for-profit sector of the economy that is involved in construction right now in the entire United States is private prisons.
Yeah.
It is incredibly profitable. So here you have the cons saying, oh, we can't pay for educating people. So kids get it. A lot of kids get it that their parents don't have the means for them to go to college. They don't have the grades necessarily to get a scholarship. And there's no way that they even have the credit to qualify for, much less could afford, student loans. And they get that by the time they're 12, 13 years old, that there's no way that they're going to complete college. And without a college education, their only hope is going to be to get a job at Burger King. And that ain't going to make it for them. They can make more money out on the streets, selling drugs or whatever. And so they say to hell with it, and they drop out of school, and they go into the underground economy. And the result of that is that it drives profits in our private prison business. And the conservatives look at that and go, isn't that wonderful? My stock in Marriott just went up, which is big in the private prison business. I mean, it is absolutely crazy. John, excellent point. Thank you very much for making it. And Kenny in Baltimore. Kenny, my brother, one of my three brothers is a union electrician in Michigan, and he was telling me a couple of weeks ago that a lot of the truckers that he knows and he hangs out with, he travels around the state. I'm not going to name the company that he works for, but in any case, he knows and works with a whole bunch of truckers, and he said they're all talking about a strike today.
Well, we shut it down. It's a lot of independents. Even CNN and them are starting to do a story on it now because a lot of them didn't think it was going to start happening, but all the company drivers that can't stop is doing 45 miles an hour down the interstate.
Wow.
And all the independents that can stop is just pulling over. Right now, I'm shut down in Massachusetts right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sitting in a truck stop. But
listening to us on Sirius, I assume. The president, I talked about this last week on the program, and we had that quote from the president of the Independent Truckers Association, arguably your union or association anyway, who said that, no, we really can't do this. And so this is an unofficial strike, right? This is just organized by independents on CB radio.
Yeah, this is organized all over the, just over the CB radio. And I think it started with a guy that started a website on it. But, I mean, people keep talking about gasoline making the $4. Our diesel is over $4 a gallon.
Yeah.
And we don't get but 5 miles to the gallon. So people can do the math on that. So I'd say to people, y'all better get what y'all can get off the shelves and get y'all groceries because we're not playing with this.
Yeah. Are you guys going to be down for 1 day, 3 days, longer?
We're talking about doing it for the whole week and see what it is. Now, once other drivers see that it's for real, they will start catching on and start shutting down, too. So
yeah, that will get people's attention. I remember in the 70s, Louisiana, in 72, I think it was, or 73, whichever year the trucker strike as a result of the gas spike, as a result of the war in the Middle East, as a result of the air boycott happened, we were living in Detroit. And I remember two things very vividly of that. One is that when I think it was Nixon was president at the time, imposed the alternate, if your license plate ended with odd or even numbers, you could gas up on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that kind of thing. People actually getting shot at gas pumps. I remember that. And I remember when the trucker strike happened that the stores in Detroit, we actually lived in the suburbs of Detroit out in Inkster and Westland. We lived in a town called Westland, which was between Inkster and Livonia, that the shelves in the stores just went empty. I mean, of virtually everything important within a day or two. It was incredible.
Yeah, well, they don't take that long,
Yep. You're absolutely right. Well, Kenny, good luck, you guys. Good
all
luck.
Right, man.
And thanks for the call, and shout out to all our truckers who are listening there. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. Two quick points. Two of the things that made this country great in the 20th century were mandatory public K-12 that was free and the GI Bill.
Yep.
And it seems that a logical step for the 21st century is to make college cheaper and more accessible for folks, not less,
yep,
as the current trend is. And the second point is when it comes to regards to education and poverty, the poor in this country live in poverty enclaves where they are basically surrounded, their models are people that have not been able to succeed financially. And if one of them does happen to figure it out, they usually leave the neighborhood, and there goes that influence.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to do two things. We need to have financial literacy part of the core curriculum, K through 12,
Yep.
And I think we need to have adult financial literacy centers in these poor areas to help people get these skills, to get them out of these areas.
I absolutely agree. I've often said I think it's amazing and frankly embarrassing that people graduate from high school not knowing how to change a diaper and not knowing how to balance a checkbook.
And one last thing, Tom. In these neighborhoods, you have predatory cash advance places, pawn shops, you know, all the wrong kind of influences. And what a wonderful thing it would be if business and the government would get together to try to instill these skills. And it would benefit our whole economy. You know, you're creating customers for your neocons.
Yep. And these are the issues, by the way. Let's you know, put a fine point on this. I started this thing out by pointing out that Bill Clinton raised this issue yesterday here in Portland, and Barack Obama's been talking about it as well, Hillary Clinton talking about it. The Democrats are on point on this stuff. John McCain doesn't want to have anything to do with any of it. Excellent point. Thank you very much for the call, Rich. From Rich in Alabama to Rich in Connecticut. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I work for a company that's owned by Norwegians, and several of them were over here recently, and we were just talking about the graduation, the school system in Norway and versus here, and they told me that in Norway they have a 98% graduation rate.
Right.
And the engineer who specifically was talking to me said that his high school hasn't had a recorded dropout since before World War II. And I couldn't believe that. And they showed me on the web, and I showed him on the web our statistics, and it was like he couldn't believe how some of our schools have such a high dropout rate.
Well, there are a couple of major differences. Number one, Norway really funds their schools. They have excellent schools. We have been cutting the funding of our schools ever since Ronald Reagan came into office and proposed that, you know, he brought in, well, wasn't Reagan who brought in Bill Bennett as the Secretary of Education with the explicit purpose of shutting down the Department of Education? As I recall, and Reagan was, you know, promoting the idea of, you know, let's privatize our public school system, and the conservatives have been pushing this thing, trying to whack away at our public school system. Number one, number two, so their schools are better funded. Number two, anybody in Norway who has a high school diploma can get a decent job, and if they can't get a decent job, they can get into college, and it's free. In fact, not only is it free to go to college in Norway and all of the other Scandinavian countries as well, in most of them, they will pay you a stipend to go to college because they realize that they, as a people, are investing in the intellectual infrastructure and the future of their nation. And, it's just like, it's nuts. It's just absolutely screaming nuts. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Rennie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rennie.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say I'm communications chair of WashTech.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to their website at washtech.org.
Now, what is WashTech? That's the education union?
It's an IT union.
Mm-hmm.
We're part of a local of the communication workers union.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say, and I'm an activist as well, I wanted to talk about the H-1B issue. Senator Maria Cantwell is going around Washington State right now doing these roundtable discussions. And he titled them Jobs for Us and Jobs for Our Kids. But they, you know, and I went to one of these discussions, and the problem is she's talking to CEOs and presidents. And she's asked the,
didn't you?
Well, I got in, but I was part of the audience. If you were not president,
so
you got
she's
to
having,
the audience.
Oh, interesting.
So you didn't get to participate, except there was a little short question and answer session at the end.
Yeah.
And what these CEOs are saying, just saying that there's a shortage of workers, they can't find a skilled worker.
Yeah, and every time we hear that on this show, I mean, I've had conservatives come on this show, and we've done this show before. We've done that before, where they come on and they go, oh, you know, we just can't find good tech workers. We can't find good software engineers. And then, you know, the board just lights up with people going, hey, I'm a software engineer, and I'm making, you know, X, or I'll work for, you know, Y, all over the country, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
There are people in this country who work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, send it on down the line.
There you go. And the Tom Hartman program, the most union-friendly program in the nation. The Tom Hartman, you're speaking behind the good old stainless steel working-class microphone. The Tom Hartman program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. Find out more at teamster.org. And I'm telling you, strange stuff going on out there. The economy, this is how bad the economy is. That in Eugene, Oregon, just down the road from us here, the gasoline thieves are stealing gas from the police. This is incredible. Michael Gilbert is a Eugene police sergeant. He barely got his police-issued Chevrolet Tahoe to the gas station to refill. It's not a marked Tahoe, he says, but if they bothered looking at it at all, they could see it's a police vehicle. It was more than a little irritating. Gas thieves hitting a police car and stealing gas. That's how bad our economy is. Phil in Florida. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi.
Hey.
First, I want to tell you what's going on here in Florida. Under the leadership of the conservative Republican Jeb Bush, when he left office, we were $1.1 billion in the red.
Right.
Now, after a year or so of Mr. Crist, we're $4.5 billion in the red.
Yeah, Republicans really know how to run up debts, don't they?
Well, what's interesting is an article just came out that people are voting with their feet. The number of people who are leaving Florida is the highest in history.
Wow.
We are losing population. Okay?
Yeah.
Like crazy. They're closing schools because of people voting with their feet and saying we're out of here. Because wages are very, very low.
Yeah.
Okay. And the cost of living is high. This place is basically designed by the Republicans as a place for the wealthy only.
Yeah. This is your, you know, they're trying to turn Florida into a gated community, basically.
Well, here's the thing.
Except that they need the workers, so they've got to have these little outposts of poor people who can come in and work.
Well, basically, the state is divided into two sections. You have the wealthy, and then that's in one section. Then the other section is the people who serve the wealthy.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not, I lived in Georgia for 13 years, you know, right, state next door to you, and I've spent a lot of time in Florida. And what you're describing is not just Florida. What you're describing in large part is becoming the entire United States, but in particular over the last 20 or 30 years has been, arguably longer than that, has been the South. And Florida was immune from the problems of the South to some extent throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, particularly after the invention of air conditioning in the 1950s. I mean, that really fueled the second big boom in Florida real estate, the first being in the 1920s. And now, you know, all these years of Republican mismanagement and Republican destruction of the not just the ecosystem and the environments in Florida, but as well the economy is coming home to roost, and Florida is starting to feel the pain that the rest of the South is, in my opinion.
But here's the kicker. This state is structured in a way that no other state is structured. Example, if you are wealthy and you go to Palm Beach and you buy a home for cash, let's say you write out a check for $1 million because you're wealthy, there's no tax. But if you are working at the Texaco and you buy a $110,000, 900-square-foot house, you have to pay a tax.
A sales tax.
Yeah.
Why would you not have to pay a sales tax on $1 million house?
Because they have excluded anybody who pays cash.
You're kidding!
No. They call it, the tax is called a tax stamp, but it's another word for a sales tax.
That's amazing.
Let me tell you some more, real quick.
Yeah.
What do you think it costs to buy a license plate for a Porsche 911?
I don't know.
$39.
Incredible.
What do you think the cost of a license is for a 100-foot powerboat?
I don't know.
150.
Yeah, see, I can tell you in every other state, you know, as that's absolutely nuts. Phil, thanks for the heads up on this stuff. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Peter in Colorado. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Yeah, I just want to tell you the consequences of a poor education. I just got out of the Army, and no disrespect to the brave people that are in Iraq, but most of them could not hold a job other than be in the Army, and they're fit to die, but they're not fit to do anything else.
Yeah, this is the tragedy. The tragedy of America is that we're producing people for prison and we're producing cannon fodder. You know, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "I hope I shall never live to see the day that in my nation a man is willing to be shot at for a sixpence." And he was arguing in favor of against a volunteer army and in favor of a draft.
Well, it's more than a volunteer army. What you've got is a foreign legion. That's essentially what we've got. And when this war is over and those guys come back, what do you think is going to happen on the streets? If they think Vietnam was a problem, these guys, regardless of PTSD, they're not qualified to do anything else.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough one. Peter, thanks for the heads up on that. Frank in Canoga Park, California. Hey, Frank, got about a minute before we got to wrap up this hour.
Yeah, you know, in California, we have a 45% graduation rate in high school because we have these exit exams. I never had one, and I think if a kid stays through high school, they deserve to graduate without an exit exam. This is a typical plot to get these kids.
But see,
stay another year to take that exit exam, they're going to just drop out, and they're going to be a sub-class citizen because they're not going to get a job.
I don't think the exit exams were designed to cause people to drop out. I mean, the bottom line is if our schools were appropriately and properly funded, and if people knew that if they graduated from high school, regardless of the wealth of their parents, they could go to college for free and get a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a PhD, they could go as far as they wanted, you would see the dropout rate falling like a stone, like it has all across Europe. If people knew that they could get a good union job, you know, like back in the days when I was a kid, you know, growing up in Lansing, Michigan, where Oldsmobile, you know, is, half my friends worked at the Oldsmobile factory after they got a high school diploma, and they were making, you could raise a family on that kind of a paycheck. 57 minutes past the hour. What about the subprime mess coming up next?
The Tom Hartman Program for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, an analyst for Morgan Stanley says he sees that the financial service industry is facing the most severe investment banking crisis in 30 years. This in today's news, no, it's not an April Fool's story. UBS writing down $19 billion, the Swiss banking giant. Deutsche Bank writing down $3.9 billion, the German bank. And with us now on the line is Brian Myers. He's the head of sales for ING Direct USA. ingdirect.com, the website. Is it pronounced ing or ing, Brian?
Ing.
Ing. And you're the guys that we see the ads for on TV with the lion and all that?
That would be us, yes.
And are you a division of the Dutch company?
Yeah. ING stands for International Netherlands Group.
That's right. Okay, great. So I'm looking right now at an article in today's New Zealand newspaper. In the stuff.co.nz, it says more than $200 million of ING's two frozen funds carrying $520 million of investors' money is irrecoverable, says an analyst of Diversified Investment Strategies. Back in 2003, you guys wrote down several billion dollars. You're getting hit by this subprime mess.
Well, not ING Direct, the banking side. I mean, we're seeing very minimal losses. We've not had the issues that the rest of the world has had. In New Zealand, I do know they have some issues there, but there's nothing significant here in the U.S. With ING Direct and the banking side, because basically we made loans to people that could pay them back.
Yeah, I know. You know, I was looking on your website. I noticed that you have adjustable rate loans, and I guess the good thing is that, and you know, I salute you for this. You say these adjustable rate loans, your orange direct loans,
yep.
can only increase by 6% over the life of the loan, even though it's an adjustable rate loan. It can go up 2% per year after the term, which can be 1 to 10 years. But there are some folks out there who have been lending to people, and you were talking about 80% collateralization as well, which is a healthy thing. But there have been people in your business who have been loaning at 100% of collateralization and with no cap on how high the interest rates can jack up and or how quickly they can. And you know, what we're discovering now is that people are walking away from these mortgages, and it's creating an economic meltdown. What do you think what are your thoughts about the bailout here of this multi-billion-dollar bailout that the U.S. government has engineered for a company that's not even insured by the FDIC, for an investment bank rather than a real bank?
Well, I think the issue here is there's just such upheaval, and you know, every time that I've spoken on one of these shows, typically it's, well, who's at fault? And it comes down to, well, there were consumers that were at fault that were obviously buying things that they shouldn't have been and not reading disclosures, and then some of them were hoodwinked, which we know happened, and that's, you know, that's the mortgage brokers, a lot of them. All they cared about was originating the loan, collecting a big fee, and could care less whether the people ever paid the loan back.
The Oregonian here, our local paper, got a hold of an internal memo from J.P. Morgan Chase about how to fool the computer system to get loans approved that shouldn't be approved. I mean,
it's terrible. I mean, and I think the thing is. During this period when we had low interest rates, obviously pension funds, foreign governments, you name it, everybody was chasing yield, and Wall Street figured out a way to come up with yields, and everybody kind of looked the other way on the risk of these things, and it's unfortunate, but okay, a lot of players here got us into this mess, and it's going to take a lot. It's going to take some time. This thing that the Fed is doing, time will tell whether it's the right thing to do, but I think if we look back in time, if you look to 1929 and what happened with the crash, the government not intervening obviously led to an awful lot of suffering.
Sure.
But
see, one of the first things that the government did, I mean, one of the first pieces of legislation that Roosevelt passed in 1933 was the Glass-Steagall Act that said that banks are not going to get into the business of speculating. They're not going to get into the investment business. Banks are going to be nice, predictable, moderately profitable, boring businesses. And investment houses, you know, can come and go. They can live and die by their guesses and their wild machinations. But the two shall never again be bound, because so many banks had been speculating on stocks back then, and also in real estate. I mean, there's a huge real estate bubble that started in Florida in 1921. That started unraveling in 1925 and really blew apart in Florida in 27 and spread across the rest of the United States in 29. And that, you know, very much like today's real estate bubble. And it was fueled by similar things, you know, by very, very low interest rates and by lots and lots of speculation. And in 98, Clinton, under incredible pressure from your industry, built and lobbying pressure. I mean, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars were spent accumulatively over the years to lobby for the end of the Glass-Steagall Act. And he signed legislation undoing that piece of legislation that kept the banking system solid all these years. I mean, wasn't that crazy?
Well, in hindsight, it appears so. I think not all of it is crazy. I think the issue is if you look at all of these, this structured finance world where you have these people with PhDs in finance and that head all of these. You take a loan and you slice it up in a CMO, and you have a part that you have tranches. You have all of this ways of slicing and dicing made on all these models that when you end up with a downturn, you find out the models don't work.
Yeah, it seems to me like what we're looking at are PhDs in larceny.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just figuring out new and slick ways to basically even fool investors. But why should the federal government be in the business of bailing out investors, of people who are, as you say, chasing yield rather than bailing out individuals who got caught in the pinchers of this thing. We know that there's a racial component to this. In African-American neighborhoods, half of all the people who would have qualified for a normal fixed rate 20, 30-year mortgage, a normal prime loan, ended up with subprime loans. They were, you know, they were told that they were, that the other kinds were not available. There's clearly still redlining going on in the United States, or some variation on that. We know that there's a, you know, fooled you component, as you pointed out. I mean, you know, when was the last time anybody ever, you know, read the 14 pages of fine print that comes with a mortgage? I mean, you know, I've had a number of mortgages over the years. I read it once, you know, I suppose. I remember there was a phrase in there that says, I surrender my rights under the 13th and 14th, two amendments to the Constitution. And I'm like, I have to sign this? And the guy was like, yeah, if you want the mortgage. I mean, you know, but people don't read all that fine print. And even if they do, they don't know how to translate it. I understand, you know, Franklin Roosevelt bailing out individuals, and he did in 33, 34, 35, and 36. But I don't understand my taxpayer dollars and your taxpayer dollars bailing out millionaires and billionaires.
Well, I think everybody is against that. I think the problem, though, is if, let's say, and again, probably the most scary part is what we don't know, okay?
Yeah.
You know, about the bottom line of where the economy is.
In other words, you're agreeing with this Morgan Stanley analyst.
So I think the issue is obviously there had to have been a pretty extreme situation that would cause the Fed to do what they did. My understanding is what they've done is they've provided liquidity to the investment houses. The collateral are these mortgage pools. Now, I have no idea, you have no idea what the quality of them is. If it is a situation that this we get through this process of retraction in the market and hopefully values stabilize and we get better interest, obviously interest rates are coming down at the expense of savers. That's the other people getting hit on this now. But the point is we end up with a situation where if people can refinance, if we can get over the hump, hopefully then with time, I assume this is what they're thinking, I don't know, but with time, you know, it's not going to be total loss. I mean, the problem is the whole market just went away. So you can't sell these securities at all. There's just
well, and to the extent that the Fed is trying to jack up liquidity, I mean, we're now again in negative interest rate territory, and still nobody's buying. I mean, there's no credit out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about the ramifications in the economy. If you do nothing, I mean, and you go into depression, obviously.
Right, that's it's Herbert Hoover all over again.
Well, exactly.
But this administration is saying, well, let's just privatize the whole thing. We'll give it off to the Fed, which is a private corporation. It's not a government entity.
Could be.
Yeah, okay. Brian, I really appreciate your coming on. Brian Myers, he's the head of sales for ING Direct USA. ingdirect.com is the website. Not one of the bad players in this thing, and I appreciate your being willing to discuss this with us on the air.
Thank you.
Good talking with you, Brian. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Now everywhere I go, they're glad to see that plastic cart. And no matter what the cost is, you know getting it ain't hard. You sign along the dotted line, you can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay.
Old MasterCard.
You mastered me. I'll still be paying when I'm 83.
The things I bought
are broke or gone.
Old MasterCard.
Where'd I go wrong?
And here's the problem. Americans are using their MasterCards and their Visas and their other credit cards to buy food, to buy gas, to make their home payments, their mortgage payments. I mean, this you have average credit card debt in the United States, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, between $7,000 and $9,000 per worker in this country. That's pretty mind-boggling. So today, in the New York Times, Larry Rother and Edmund Andrews, drawing a sharp distinction between himself and the two Democratic presidential candidates. Senator John McCain of Arizona warned Tuesday against vigorous government action to solve the deepening mortgage crisis. McCain's comments came a day after Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York called for direct federal intervention to help affected homeowners, including a $30 billion fund for states and communities to assist those at risk of foreclosure. And Mrs. Clinton's Democratic opponent, Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, similarly called for greater federal involvement, including creation of a $10 billion relief package to prevent foreclosures. So John McCain, in place of large-scale government assistance, Mr. McCain recommended two immediate but limited measures. He said that accountants should meet. This is what John McCain wants to do. This is his economic plan for the mortgage crisis. Accountants should meet to review the system by which real estate and real assets are valued. So number one, he wants accountants to get together and talk to each other. And number two, he urged mortgage lenders to step forward voluntarily to help creditworthy borrowers who may be strapped for cash at the moment. Yeah, right. And if you believe that, I have a bridge for you. Now, here's what Franklin Roosevelt did back in the 1930s. And this is a great lesson. I mean, there are incredible similarities here. Jakubowicz, I believe is how it's pronounced, writing in the New Republic, he opens his piece, FDR Solves the Mortgage Crisis, with this great quote from Franklin Roosevelt from April 7, 1932. He said, "Here should be an objective of government itself," this is Franklin Roosevelt, "to provide at least as much assistance to the little fellow as it is now giving to the large banks and corporations." That's how Franklin Roosevelt began his campaign for presidency. This is in April of 1932. Of course, he won the election in November of 32. So here we've got these exotic home loans, which basically are interest-only loans or something very close to it. Interest-only for the first 4, 5, 6, 8 years, whatever, and then, boom, it goes to interest and principal. We call them exotic loans, but that was actually the normal kind of home mortgage in the 1920s. During the Roaring Twenties, most people were getting 5 years, 6 years, sometimes 8, 9, or 10 years, but almost never more than 10 years, sometimes only 2 and 3 year loans that were 100% interest only balloon payment loans. That was what was normal. Those were normal home mortgages in the 1920s. Now, why, you would ask yourself, would anybody get a 3 year balloon payment interest only loan? Well, the answer is because housing values, particularly in some parts of the country like Florida, housing values were going up 30, in some cases 20, 30, 40% a year. There was an explosion in housing prices during the so-called Roaring Twenties. And so people were doing then the same thing that people were doing last year, the year before that. Over the last decade, they were saying, hey, you know, the price of the home is going to keep going up. So I'll get a loan where in 3 years it's going to go, you know, the rate is going to go up. But in 3 years, I'll simply, you know, I'll have more equity in the house. So I'll simply roll the loan over again. And then the stock market crash of October 29 and the beginning of the Republican Great Depression hit us, and people couldn't get credit. They couldn't roll their loans over, and they were freaking out. People were walking away from their houses. This was the beginning of the Great Depression. This happened in the 1920s. I mean, we've seen this movie before. There aren't very many people alive who remember it, but it's right there in the history books to track down. So what did Franklin Roosevelt do? Now, by the way, in 1931, this is when the first batch of three-year mortgages insured in 1928 and five-year mortgages from 1926 came due. In 1931, the bank foreclosure rate in the U.S. on mortgages was 1.4%. Right now, it's 1.23%, and the guess is it's going to hit 1.6% by the end of this year. So we are right now in the same territory we were in 1931, as we entered the depths of the Great Depression. So what did Franklin Roosevelt do? And by the way, housing values were dropping. A middle-class house, as Andrew notes, a middle-class house worth $5,000 in 1926 was worth only $3,300 in 1932. So what he did is he created the Homeowners Loan Corporation. This was a federal agency that really only lasted for about 4 years and was eventually liquidated at a profit, that lent money directly to homeowners, that said to homeowners, you got a loan, you can't afford to pay it back, we'll convert that into a 10, 15, or 20-year loan, which will reduce your payments. It is an amortizing loan. In other words, over the course of that loan, when you're all done paying it off, you will fully own your own home rather than an interest-only loan like most people had with the banks at the time. And it was incredible. And you had to get individualized attention. You got debt counseling. There were family meetings, and there was budgeting help. This was all paid for as part of this program. It was a not-for-profit program. It was run by the government. It worked. These are called the HOLC loans. There was nearly 1.9 million of them between 1933 and 1935. And it saved the country. It's time to do the same. 28 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. 4 minutes past the hour. Strange things going on. Strange, totally strange. People get dizzy from what they're eating and drinking here. This post by John Doe. We had a coffee fund. The boss never paid, and he drank most of the coffee. X-Lax looks just like coffee creamer after you remove the candy shell. Awful quiet around there for a couple of weeks, but he paid for the coffee from then on. I remember back long ago and far away, living in East Lansing back in the late 60s. We have a bunch of us living in this house, and there was one guy who kept eating everybody's food. And so Java Man, who owned the house, made this cake, and he filled it with chocolate X-Lax. That was the chocolate. This was the chocolate in the cake. And then he put a big sign out that said, "Warning, do not eat this cake," and put it in the refrigerator. And the next day, there was a big piece of the cake gone, and one of the guys living in the house didn't leave the bathroom all day long. So it wasn't an April Fool's joke, was it? But close. If you got an interesting April Fool's story, you can let us know as well. But I think this is actually, you know, this topic that we've been talking about in this hour of how do we resolve this issue. This reflects a very real difference in worldview between conservatives and liberals. I mean, let's just lay it right out. And I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second. But first, I want to share with you this just little snippet. It's only about a minute and a half from the debate between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960, which perfectly illustrates this. Now, this was not about how do you deal with a mortgage crisis, because there wasn't a mortgage crisis at that time. But there was another crisis at that time. And that is, how can we enfranchise people? The Brown versus Board of Education was 1954. And it said you can no longer have legal segregation in the school systems in the United States. And Kennedy was saying government needs to get involved. Nixon was saying, let's go to private industry. Here's Nixon's first.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do?
So what do you do, Mr. Nixon?
Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
Right. So you just exactly what John McCain is calling for with regard to the mortgage crisis. Call in the executives of the companies and ask them to voluntarily do something. And they thumbed their nose at Nixon in 1958 and 59 and 1960, and they're thumbing their nose at us now. So John Kennedy weighs in.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. He's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights.
So, you know, John Kennedy's saying, you know, no, there's a role for government in this. We're going to take names and kick butt. We're going to get something done here. Sandra in Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I just had to call you because I was in the loan business, and that's another story. I don't want to go into that right now. But I just want to say I think we should let them all crash because in the 20s, people made money during the crash. And I know
sure.
that the government's already trying to bring out the Amaro. They want the everything to crash. They just want to make money at the same time. So
this is disaster capitalism. This is what Naomi Klein wrote about. It's disaster capitalism. Create a disaster and figure out a way to make money on it. And change the structure of everything at the same time. What the Republicans are talking about, what the Bush administration is talking about right now is actually reducing regulation, doing away with the Securities and Exchange
right.
Commission, and increasing the power of a non-governmental agency, the private, the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board. And that, you know, it's you're spot on, Sandra, and well said. Thank you very much for the call. John in Van Nuys, California. Hey, John.
Tom, it's so good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I'm a long-time listener. This is the first time I've called in. I'll tell you, this whole subprime market thing has just got my blood boiling. You know, and what I see that, like, the major news sources don't even get to the source of the issue, which is the repeal of the
the Glass-Steagall Act.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't hear anybody talking about that at all.
Nope.
Now, there's another thing that I noticed, too, the other day when I was researching this. I was actually blogging this on an automotive car buff website. And you'll be surprised that a lot of the guys, well, I don't know about surprised, but a lot of these people are very, you know, conservative in mind. There was a story that was buried on page 825, February 14th of this year, written by Elliot Spitzer, who talks about the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
I read that.
Now, did he really?
Yeah, Spitzer basically said, this government is creating an economic disaster, and I am going to go after them and do something about it. And then, boom, all of a sudden, he's being prosecuted for picking up a hooker.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's a correlation.
Or he's being outed for it, right?
Too, because I'm not a doomsday person. But,
yeah.
You know, all 50 states' attorneys generals were pushing the administration to do something about this.
Yeah.
And there again, asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, and you know, the reason why nobody talks about the Glass-Steagall Act is because it was repealed by a Democratic president, and,
right.
and a lot of Democrats voted for its repeal. Everybody thought, hey, it's a great idea. It's, you know, these are the roaring 90s. Everything's fine. I mean, it was the same mentality in the 1920s, and so the Democrats are a little embarrassed about it. The Republicans are you know, just don't want to talk about it, period, because they don't think there should be any regulation. They opposed Glass-Steagall when it was passed in 33. They've opposed it every year since then. They tried to repeal it in the 40s. There was a 2 years, 46, 40, or 47, 48, when they controlled the you know Congress and vetoed Harry Truman's attempt to have single payer health insurance and overrode his veto of Taft-Hartley and you know they tried to do away with Glass-Steagall then they couldn't. People still remembered what was going on and they finally got rid of it and it's like you know it's like the crazy aunt in the upstairs bedroom or you know whatever metaphor you want to use of you know the thing
oh, yeah.
that nobody wants to talk about and it's the embarrassing laundry of the Democratic Party and it's the obviously embarrassing and destructive legacy of the Republican Party as well. John, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Jeff in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Hey, it's great to talk to you. I really respect you a lot. I got both Screwed and Cracking the Code.
Oh, thank you. Two books I wrote.
You know, you have both of them.
Yeah.
Actually, I got them both for Christmas.
Oh, that's
this
nice.
I'm a former Navy rescue swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm really ticked off about is yesterday somebody called you and they were really writing you about, you know, having a section about how do we do something.
Right.
I have a sister who is a state senator. She, you know, whatever. Why don't they read the Constitution of the
yeah.
United States of America?
It's a great start.
And really become a constitutional lawyer. And sit there and read what our forefathers, why they were so ambiguous. They're ambiguous for a reason. And when it comes to McCain, which is originally why I called, I used to be a McCain supporter when I was about 8 years old. I have been waterboarded, as a lot of us have been who are, you know, anybody in special ops. We've all been to Sierra School and all that fun
mm-hmm.
stuff. I want to ask any one of them to go through that. And I just asked my dad before I left, you know, and he was in the Cuban quarantine. I said, Dad, what did your officers think about that? What do you think about Senator McCain? Said everybody said he was a crybaby. You know, that's not really fair to him. He's a veteran. I respect
yeah.
him for what he did, and he's a fellow brother of mine. But, you know, all this stuff is namby-pamby, and the people call up and they say, Tom, oh, what do we do about this about subprime? And I understand that these are things that really concern them right now.
Yeah, but your point is let's start with the Constitution, let's get back to the basics. Let's do something about it. Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. Well said, absolutely. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, Michael in California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. It was interesting you brought up the Homeowners Loan Corporation. I was going to talk about that if I had time.
Which became the FHA, by the way. It kind of morphed into the Federal Housing Administration.
Yeah.
Which is how my dad got a mortgage in the 1950s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been very concerned about the financial system for the last 10 years, and it goes back to two things. First of all, Glass-Steagall. My wife and I talk about stuff like this, and I remember when they repealed it, I told her this is a really dangerous idea. And I have a degree in history, so I have an acquaintanceship with the New Deal and all of that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really got me was the long-term capital management story in 1998, because there was a very good book written about this called When Genius Failed by the New York Times writer Roger Lowenstein.
Yep.
And there's several parts of it, but the main part is this classic tale of hubris. These two Nobel Prize winning economists teamed up with this bond trader, and they set up this computer program in a hedge fund, and they thought that they had risk all licked. Well, it turned out that they didn't. And then the second part of the story is the Fed riding to the rescue. Okay, and so the Fed rides to the rescue and puts this rescue package together.
Did the Fed bail out long-term capital management?
The Fed didn't.
I thought it was the Treasury Department. It was
no,
the Fed?
No, it was the head of the New York Fed at the time, McDonnell, I think his name was.
So there's a precedent for what the Fed just did.
Well, to a degree, yes. The Fed didn't use Fed money. They forced all the banks that were involved in it to put up the money
to do it.
Okay.
You got to wrap it up here. I'm sorry. The machine starts. I don't have any control over it.
What got me more than anything out of that book was the reckless and irresponsible behavior of the banks, which is the template for everything that's happening.
Well, and that all comes out of, you know, the mantra of the Reagan 80s, which is greed is good, you know, and greed leads to...
You go back 25 years and you'll see seven times when the taxpayers and the Fed had to bail out the reckless behavior of the financial...
45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Welcome back to the radio. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us in just a moment. First, I wanted to get a quick call in here from Kip in Santa Fe. Kip, you've been patiently waiting. You lived through the 1930s Depression?
That's right. I was 7 years old in 32, and I remember my dad very well. He had had a good middle-level executive job, but by 32, he was out selling pens and pencils and graduated to trying to sell oil burners, and finally, back in about 36, 37, he got his job back in the corporation he'd been working with. So it was a tough time, but yesterday, here in Santa Fe, we had a wonderful program. I just want to mention it to you as briefly as I can. It was a commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the New Deal, which, as you know, was signed 75 years ago yesterday.
Was it yesterday? I thought it was last week.
Well, this was held in Santa Fe. It's either mañana or ayer around here. You can take your choice. But anyway, they had a speaker here, an actor really named Richard Merrill, whose skill at impersonating or being FDR was really magical, and he spoke without a script at some length about all the accomplishments that you've been discussing this morning. FDR did during the Depression. And I'd just like real quick to read a couple of items here that,
Kip, I'm sorry we don't have the time for you to read anything, but I've got to get to Ellen's news report here, which, you know,
Let me just say that Churchill said this: to meet Roosevelt with all of his buoyant aspiration, his resistance was like And his iridescence was like opening a bottle of champagne. So.
There you go. There you go. Kip, thanks a lot for the call, and thank you for listening there on KTRC. It's, FDR, and it's much appreciated. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, a lot of it's happening across the big pond, and that is NATO. Today, the president stated his support for Ukraine and Georgia entering NATO. Russia and Germany and France are against it. France will not give a green light and essentially has veto power. And Hillary Clinton came out with a statement that she also supports Ukraine and Georgia. Feels though that we have to deal with Russia, and said that kicking Russia out of the G8 is not an answer as well. The other thing that's going to be coming up with NATO is additional forces to Afghanistan, and also whether the different countries are placing restrictions on how these forces can operate. The General McNeil said he needs at least 3,000 more troops, and there's calls for as many as 10,000 more troops.
Ellen,
yeah?
a question about this, if I may. NATO was originally formed, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was originally formed as an alliance of post-World War II allies to defend themselves against Stalinist Russia.
That's right.
And Putin is very, very upset about the idea of Ukraine joining Soviet Georgia or any of the former states, the former Soviet states, but particularly those that border Russia and Europe, joining NATO, because it's going to put NATO right at his doorstep. And it's being re-perceived again as an it's an anti-Russian force. It seems that advocating, these two countries joining NATO at a time when you know it's not going to happen, the French are going to stop it from happening, for example, as you said, it's not going to happen, is a way of just sticking a thumb in Putin's eye. And I don't understand what the percentage in that is. Why would Bush, and by the way, why would Hillary Clinton be in
favor? Hillary Clinton agrees with that too, actually.
Yeah, and I'm baffled. I don't understand why. Can you enlighten me?
I wish I had the answer to that. The other thing that people don't realize is that when a country chooses to join NATO, it costs them. They have to put in a certain amount of their military, and their budget has
right.
to
this
go
is
to
a
that.
Military organization. This is not like joining the G8. This is not like joining an economic partnership of some kind.
Exactly. And a lot of countries have a hard time meeting that military obligation.
Right. Right. And then we've got NATO forces now in don't we have NATO forces in Afghanistan?
We have a lot of NATO forces in Afghanistan.
Yeah, which again is like, why NATO? I mean, it seems to me like there needs to be a discussion, a very open discussion, frankly, among the NATO countries about what the purpose of NATO is anymore. Or if they think that, Putin actually is moving Russia back in the kind of Stalinist direction. I mean, they still have 8,000-9,000 nuclear warheads. And is NATO actually a force to contain Russia? And if so, let's just be explicit about it.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of people, I mean, this is the whole issue of Ukraine is a very touchy issue for Russia. And we know that.
Yeah. And Bush is trying to have it both ways.
Absolutely.
And I just don't think it'll work. Okay, you were moving along.
I was moving along to Steny Hoyer's pen and pad. He sent out today a whole written information and gave it to the reporters this morning. He called the economy under Bush an unmitigated disaster and reiterated some employment figures that I think that you know about, but I'll just go through them quickly. Unemployment raising from 6 to 7.4 million people. A medium household income decreased by 1,000. Lack of health care from 38 million people when Bush took over to 47 million people. 28 million people on food stamps, and inflation adjusted tuition increasing 36.3% for college tuition. So he really went very, very heavy on the Bushies on that today.
Yeah, good on him.
Well, what's interesting, though, is he's doing that, but they're not really, I mean, you had this morning at people like John McCain on the, the morning shows, but why aren't they pushing the economy? Why aren't the Democrats pushing the problem?
Dan Abrams does this segment called Teflon John, and every day he points out some story that about John McCain that if it was something that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama had done or said, the media would have been all over it, and they would have been calling it a gaffe, and they would have been said, this is the end of the campaign, and McCain just kind of skates on all this stuff.
Well, he's gaining at this point because everybody's so focused on the Dems. And by the way, Speaker Pelosi was on one of the morning shows this morning talking about that Clinton does have a right, that she's not necessarily just, you know, saying this to get Obama elected, et cetera, that she does have a right to continue with the with her campaign.
Well, she certainly does. She certainly does. And you know, the question is, you know, is it going to help elect a Democrat as president at the end of the year? And I don't think any of us know the answer to that. Helen Radner, thanks. TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Helen.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. A lot of strange stuff going on in the world today. I think, frankly, the strangest one is this whole notion that when you take your hands off the steering wheel, essentially, of the economy. You simply say, it doesn't matter, you know, we'll just let anything happen that's going to happen. No problem. Well, you know, it's just leave it up to the predators, leave it up to the banks, leave it up to the speculators, leave it up to the gamblers on Wall Street. And then the economy, as it has historically done, when governments have done this sort of thing, not just in the United States, but certainly we saw it at the beginning of the Republican Great Depression in 1929. We're seeing it again now. When the predators run the market into the ground and run off with all the loot, then the cons come along and say, no problem. We got ours. And the rest of us, the Americans, the patriots, say, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, we're all in this together. We've got to do something about this. We've got to make sure it doesn't happen again. We've got to pull this thing together. And so both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have strong, comprehensive programs for dealing with the mortgage crisis, for dealing with the economic crisis, for reinstituting some sort of oversight and regulation. John McCain, on the other hand, walking away from this thing. He's got nothing. He's got nothing going on at all. And there's virtually no discussion of it at all in the media, which just blows my mind. I mean, that John McCain just, you know, his idea, his plan is to ask the banks to voluntarily extend credit to people who can't pay their mortgages. Voluntarily. Yeah, right. Like, that's going to happen. And to ask economists to get together and talk. I mean, this is just like, you know, Herbert Hoover's campaign slogan in 1932. In the election of 32, when Herbert Hoover, who presided over the last Republican Great Depression, Herbert Hoover's campaign slogan was, prosperity is just around the corner. I am waiting for John McCain to start using that. It's going to happen any day. Steve in Albany, New York, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, our website. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to call, and I'm doing my taxes here today, listening to you. And I'm a programmer, a webmaster for a company called the Biweekly Mortgage Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I'd call in and make some comments about how mortgages actually work. And one of the things that really got my attention is you're talking about the weird mortgages people are getting. We mm-hmm. had a member who had a potential client in Florida who wanted us to calculate what his biweekly mortgage would be for a 30-year interest-only loan.
Wow.
Which I never even, you know, the programs I made, it is just so bizarre.
Well, it's taking advantage of the tax deductibility of mortgage interest to basically rent with a tax deduction.
Exactly. But you know, the thing, I have no sympathy for these banks at all, because a really good book out there is it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island, that talks about the creation of the Fed.
Yep.
And you know, what most people don't realize is that their mortgages, well, for for one, a lot of the world actually pays their mortgages biweekly because they pay off what we pay off in 30 years, they pay off in 23.
Right. And in fact, if you, and you know, when Louise and I were first married, the first house we bought, I used to do this about a week before the payment was due. I'd send in an extra $100 or an extra $50 or whatever I could afford against my mortgage. And it's amazing. I mean, this was back when that kind of money actually meant something.
Right.
But, you know, back in the 70s. But it's amazing how quickly you can start paying down a mortgage if you just start kicking in a little extra periodically, or
yeah,
if you make your payments
absolutely
twice a month instead of once a month.
Absolutely. But the other thing, too, is, like, you know, banks are able to loan more than what they actually have on hand, about nine times.
Right.
So for them to loan you $100,000, they need to have $12,000 on hand. They create the other, you know, 88.
Right. It's called the fractional banking system. And this is where the money supply expands and contracts, because as you have more and more deposits that are being lent against, you have an expansion in the money supply, and as banks are more and more reluctant to lend money out and deposits start going down, you have a contraction in the money supply. And
or if people fail to repay their loans, you have
right
a contraction in the money supply as
right
well.
Right.
And so you should let it happen, otherwise you're going to have rampant inflation. You know, the other thing, too, with mortgages is that people don't even start to pay back their principal for about 7 years. You know, most of that first 7 years is just,
it's like 99% interest. Right. And that's the most profitable. Those are the most profitable years of the mortgage for the bank, because they're making actually like a 92%, you know, return on investment. And the average person in America moves every 7 years, or used to be.
Exactly. They know
and,
that.
And, yeah.
And so the whole thing is just, you know, I have no sympathy for the banks because they're crying poverty. And in reality, as soon as you paid them back $12,000, they haven't lost anything.
Yeah, no, it's an incredibly, you're absolutely right, Stephen. Thanks for making the point. It's an incredibly profitable business. And in many ways, and particularly with some of these new devices, the new mortgage devices, it resembles a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it's downright strange. Don in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I decided to look at the value of Chevron and Exxon shares compared to the value of a barrel of oil.
Uh-huh.
And right now, they're both around $100, and so is the value of a barrel of oil. So I looked back around 01. It was about $30 for a barrel of oil and about the same for an Exxon share. And the reason I'm calling is because now we all – I'm not talking about price fixing, but if you think about it, what's the last thing a shareholder wants is for their value of their share to go down. So I don't think we're going to see a drop in the price of oil because it's too closely tied to the values of the shares.
Right. Well, and in a larger sense, it's, you know, the price of oil to a large extent is controlled by a monopoly, that or a semi-monopoly, that being OPEC. And those countries, certainly there's a half a dozen countries in the middle, or a handful of countries, let's say, in the Middle East, that by controlling supply can control price. And they're not going to let the price significantly decrease. Good point, Don. That's fascinating. I had never seen that comparison of ExxonMobil's share price from you know, when Bush came into office until today. That's really interesting. Arnie in Florida. Hey, Arnie, what's up? Listening to Wins.
Thank you for taking my call. I have something that's been bugging me for a long time. A lot of people have talked about all the complex issues facing us today, from the election and everything else. But I have never heard one report of any casualties out of Afghanistan.
Hmm.
We hear about Iraq. We hear about all the other issues.
I typically try to lump them together
because
I think that the invasion of Afghanistan was a terrible mistake, and I think the invasion of Iraq was a terrible mistake. And the reason I think the invasion of Afghanistan was a mistake is twofold. Number one, the Taliban, the Afghan government, and which was a very unstable government, over the long term, I don't think that they would have survived. But in any case, they offered to hand Osama bin Laden over to a third country for trial if there was any evidence that he was involved in 9/11. And we should have taken their offer. I mean, you know, just, you know, and closed down the training camps. I mean, that would have been the end of it. And so, number one. And number two, every country that has ever tried to occupy Afghanistan has ended up broke. And we will too. I mean, it's a terrible mistake. The British tried it. They finally got out. The Russians tried it. You know, they were driven out. We're trying it now. It's frankly, in my opinion, and I know it's very fashionable to say, well, you know, we should have gone after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, but we shouldn't have gone into Iraq. I don't think we should. I don't have a problem with going after him in Afghanistan if you could have gone in with special operations or if you could have figured out where he was and taken him out or, you know, whatever. But taking over the entire country and installing the guy who used to be the consultant to Chevron or, one of the oil companies
right,
here,
right.
Installing him as president. And he's now, you know, Karzai is now the president of Kabul. I mean, you know, it's basically it. He controls a couple hundred square miles of the country and everything else is in the hands of either warlords of the Taliban. It's, you know, we're going down the same road Russia did. It's crazy.
I just think it's just a reflection of this last administration's policy to dumb down America.
Well, and I think that George Bush is one of these people who thinks that the answer to every problem is war. It's violence. And I have a feeling that probably in his life the answer to many of the problems was violence, perhaps directed at him. Who knows, you know, by his parents. It's the only thing I can figure out because he just, you know, it's... Abe Maslow, the famous psychologist, once said, "If the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail." And Bush's only hammer, his only tool, is war. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. 866-303-2270, our phone number, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com, our websites. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe, as the Fire Sign Theater are so fond of saying, maybe everything you know is wrong. Corey Powell is on the line with us. He's the executive editor of Discover Magazine, discovermagazine.com, their website, and one of the editors of Discover's new book, 20 Things You Didn't Know About Everything, duct tape, airport security, your body, sex and space. And in your news release, Corey, you say 20 things you don't know about mating. Do you have a chapter in Elliot Spitzer?
You can't make this stuff up. Sometimes the news delivers things that the writers can't possibly anticipate. But it relates directly to them.
Okay, great. So, you know, so what are some of the things that we don't know about, for example, aliens, your second chapter?
Well, actually, I just to sort of circle back to mating for a second, because it's sort of such a good one right now.
Yep.
So I think, you know, people have sort of been brainwashed by nature documentaries, like, you know, the sort of the March of the Penguin type things. This stuff always bounces back and forth between, you know, nature is wild and woolly and, you know, nature is so noble. Cheating isn't cheating in the animal kingdom. Cheating is just... It's sort of just the way life is. So, you know,
well, it depends on the species, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, it sort of depends. You know, if you take the sort of like the big biological view that, you know, humans are just one more animal, then, you know, hey, what Elliot Spitzer did is, you know, it's just the same thing that it's what the penguins do, it's what earthworms do, it's what wolves do, everybody does it. It's when you start to think that, you know, if you buy into the idea of humans, that we've, you know, somehow evolved out of the way that everybody else does things, that's when you sort of get a less charitable view of him.
Well, we've got actually here in Portland today, as an April Fool's joke, there are all these greenwashed gorillas. There are these gorilla actions that are happening all across the United States to draw attention to the oil industry and to some of the scams that are out there and whatnot. And one of them is actually called Cheat Neutral. Lynn Tucker of Cheat Neutral said, have you cheated on your girlfriend recently? For $19.95, we can clear up your conscience with an infidelity offset and fund someone else to be faithful and neutralize the heartache in the world. And so...
Yeah,
you know, it's tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, the carbon-neutral mindset, you know, if you...
Yeah, it's Fossil Fuels Day, you know, it's... So, other things we didn't know about mating or about sex in space, is that...
Well, sex in space, let's just touch on that for a second, because there have been so many rumors of, you know, did they or didn't they, that, you know, the Soviets had sex experiments in space, that the Americans had sex experiments in space. You know, people you know, watch that James Bond movie and they sort of get confused between James Bond and actual documentaries. As far as we know, nobody has ever had sex in space. However, there were a series of Soviet experiments and reportedly a private American experiment to see basically what exactly you would need to do it. And they came up with a series of sort of harnesses and contraptions. Back in the 60s when people were imagining that, you know, we were going to live on the moon for, you know, for years at a time and we were going to have space stations, you know, this was a real problem people worried about. How are we going to have couples living out there for a long time? These crazy things with like elastic bands and harnesses and things because
they figured it all out because without gravity it's like you know how do you stay stuck together? It's not enough gravity in your body.
That's the basic problem.
So I'm curious if
everything pushes, you know, it's Newton's laws. You push against something and it pushes against you.
Right. And then it bounces away. Corey, we're talking with Corey Powell, the executive editor of Discover Magazine. I'm wondering if you included in your everything you don't or the 20 things you don't know about aliens chapter the fact that pigeons are actually alien spies. That because because whenever there's a meeting of world leaders, there's always pigeons, and you never see a dead pigeon and you never see a baby pigeon. There are actually robotic spies from the planet Xenu.
It's funny you should mention this because This is a little known fact, but this is actually true that Stalin actually had a cat spy. Not pigeon spy.
Joseph Stalin?
No, he actually the Soviets had cats that had little cameras and microphones attached to them that they let loose in the American embassy.
I wonder if that's what happened to my cat Higgins. He's nuts and maybe he's got a transmitter in his brain or something.
Maybe you have a transmitter in his brain or maybe somebody's sitting at a webcam somewhere, you know, sort of enjoying watching your daily life.
Watching our house. Amazing.
But actually, here's another weird bit of pigeon spy trivia for you, which is, B.F. Skinner, you know, the guy who came up with the Skinner box, the idea that, you know, humans were
behaviorist,
programmable. He developed those ideas during World War II, working on a thing called Project Pigeon. They were trying to train pigeons to act as the navigators in ballistic missiles. This was before they really figured out computers, and they figured that maybe a little pigeon in there could actually, you know, read the...
Amazing. Like, well, of course it would work really well because, I mean, they're alien robots, and they've got all these nav systems from the planet Xenu. You know? Anyhow, Corey Powell, he's the executive editor of Discover Magazine. Their new book out, Discover's 20 Things You Didn't Know About Everything. And you can check it out at discovermagazine.com. Thanks, Corey, for being with us.
Sure thing.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6636 3022 70 4 minutes past the hour. I just wanted to give a shout out to Bob Furtick, who wrote a great piece for his website, Democrats.com, and just recommend it to you. It's the headline is Bush Tied to Child Prostitution by Bob Furtick. George Bush has been tied to a prostitution ring involving as many as 50,000 women and girls. The prostitutes, some as young as 13, are among the 1.2 million desperate Iraqis who fled to Syria after Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. Bush's invasion destroyed the Iraqi government and unleashed a wave of political and sectarian violence that has killed over a million Iraqis and forced 4 million to become refugees, according to the United Nations. And then he quotes Hannah Ibrahim of the Women's Will Association, says more than 50,000 women and girls have been forced into prostitution just in Syria. And then quoting a New York Times article, 70 to 80% of the girls working this business in Damascus today are Iraqis. The rents here in Syria are too expensive for their families. If they go back to Iraq, they'll be slaughtered, and this is the only work available. According to the Times, quote, inexpensive Iraqi prostitutes have helped to make Syria a popular destination for sex tourists from wealthier countries in the Middle East. In the club's parking lot, nearly half of the cars had Saudi license plates. And then, you know, Bob goes on to point out that this invasion was illegal, that it was pointed out by Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of Britain's MI6 spy agency, in a meeting that he had with Tony Blair on July 23, 2002, 8 months before the invasion of Iraq, that Bush was, quote, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of invading Iraq. I mean, the British knew that this is a crime. This is a high crime and misdemeanor. It certainly absolutely is. And we need to keep pointing this out to people, that the horrible, horrible human toll of this invasion of Iraq, this senseless invasion of Iraq. Matt in Ithaca, New York, listening on WNYY. Hey, Matt, what's up today?
Oh, I'm really glad to talk with you, Mr. Hartman.
Cool. Thank you for calling, and thank you for your patience.
Well, I love your show. It's the most informative on the radio.
Thank you.
The reason why I called is we've seen McCain blast other senators. He's cursed them. He's ranted and raved. Does this guy have post-traumatic stress? He's been in prison for years, tortured, you know, starved, denounced the United States. I'm a Vietnam veteran myself. I was wounded, decorated by two presidents. I have post-traumatic stress. You know, I know a lot of people that served in the military that have post-traumatic stress. This guy is way out there. We're going to spend time and money. We should do it here in the United States. Get out of Iraq. Get out of Afghanistan. Bring our people home. We've suffered enough. We have hundreds of thousands of people that are disabled because of this war.
Mm-hmm.
This guy...
And families that have been shattered.
Absolutely shattered. Shattered. I see
and not just American families, by the way. On our side, there are families literally from all over the world, because we have been, you know, allowing people who are not U.S. citizens to join our army. And on the Iraqi side, you got over 1 million dead people. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Absolutely. You know, it was a senseless invasion of a prosperous country, and we destroyed their infrastructure. We put people in there that shouldn't be in there. Right now we have a government that nobody's been in the military. You know, the president, maybe, you know, he did his thing in the National Guard. Wow. You know, I wish that he would have gone to Vietnam and spent at least a month, not even, just to...
Except how do you account, Matt, for the fact that McCain was there? I mean, he saw the worst of it. And yet he's gung-ho for war, too. Do you think that is PTSD, or do you think that that's his personality, or do you think that there's... I mean, you know, what's the deal? I don't get how somebody who has seen war can be so gung-ho for a war that isn't absolutely necessary and defensive.
That blows my mind. You know, we're the most out there American military that you can imagine, you know.
We're incredibly powerful.
And we brag about it, and here we don't have enough troops to take a city, let alone a country, and we keep sending people over there again and again and again, and they're going to come back, and they're going to be so screwed up they won't be able to keep a job.
Yeah. No, it's a disaster and a tragedy. So the bottom line here is you think that McCain has PTSD.
I'm a United States Marine, and I'll always be that. And I've seen combat, and I've been hand-to-hand. And this guy, I'm not afraid of a lot of stuff. But this guy really, really scares me. We're going to put him into office and have him in control of that little red button, and that's what really frightens me.
And John McCain has said, and don't be mistaken, for my friends, there will be more wars. Oh, Matt, I got to move along, but thank you
absolutely.
For the call. And thanks
very much, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks for sharing your observations with us. Oh, man. Joan in Montana, KMTP, where I was last Friday.
Hi.
Hey, Joan.
I just wanted to mention, I read a book this week called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I think it's...
Yeah, by John Perkins.
Yeah, and I think it's a nutshell, concise book of what is happening on this planet right now.
Yeah,
and
you want to read the perfect sequel to that is Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine. And then Naomi Wolf's End of America. I call them the two Naomi's.
We have a group of wealthy people, what they call it, corporatocracy or whatever.
Yeah, plutocracy.
Who have millions of people not realizing that they're part of their goon squad and they're doing their dirty work and they don't even have a clue, and those bureaucratic corporate people wouldn't get their hands dirty if their life depended on it. I don't think they'd have the guts to do it, but they use everybody and they hold everybody in contempt. And it's a really, really sad situation.
No, you're absolutely right, John. And in fact, just as an FYI, John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is being made into a movie as we speak. So keep an eye out for that.
You could just read it and it kind of gives you a picture in a nutshell.
Absolutely agree with you, Joan. You're right. It's a marvelous book. Thanks a lot for the call. I much appreciate it. 866-303-2270. Charles in Everett, Washington. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I guess my quick point is that the scary thing to me, and I don't like to buy into the fear the way we've done so well here for many years, but the scary thing to me is that John McCain and his upbringing, and in fact for several generations in his life, in his family's life, being in a state of war is a natural state of being. It's a natural condition, and we have to decide as a people, do we want our next president to consider it natural to be in this state of conflict and nation building for the benefit of the incredibly few at the expense of the tragically many?
Yeah, he comes from a family of warriors, and you're suggesting that this is sort of like the book War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning, that he's been shaped by that. Interesting point, Charles. Thank you very much for sharing that. Gray, in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Gray, what's up?
Hiya, Tom.
Hey.
Well, I have a clue that I always used to keep track of which oil company it was that was involved with Karzai before.
Uh-huh.
Unocal was trying to get a gas pipeline contract across Afghanistan for 4 years before 2001.
Yep.
And they were losing it first under the Clinton administration when the Clinton administration said, we can't do any business with these people, the Taliban government, because they are so objectionable. But, of course, it's easy to imagine that the Bushies promised Unocal, as soon as we get in, we're going to get you back in. And that's who Karzai worked for, and also the guy who was the first ambassador to Afghanistan, who then became the ambassador to Iraq. They both were working for Unocal. So
yeah. Okay.
You wouldn't forget that.
Thank you for refreshing my memory, Greg.
Yeah.
Much appreciated. And thanks for listening to us there in Detroit. Hunter in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on AM 1290 in Ann Arbor. Hey, Hunter, what's up?
About that Marine vet who just called and couldn't figure out why McCain would be such a warmonger. It seems that most of the vets we have with PTSD are ground troops who see their victims. And McCain, when he fought, was just dropping bombs on people he never saw. I think that kind of explains why, despite the rigors or all the tortures he endured in prison, that he's still gung-ho about killing people because he never actually saw his victims.
That's an interesting take on it. Thank you very much. Kent in Manhattan. Hey, Kent, what's up?
I'm the ghost of Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
Your country's currency is printed and owned by any foreign or private power, you are no longer a sovereign nation.
You're right. That was Jefferson's sentiment.
Your country was taken over. The United States was taken over in 1910 by a cabal of eight banking families. You must investigate. You must learn to find those families, and you must know.
Yep. Read the book. In agreement with you, to the extent that I agree with you, read the book, the Monster from Jekyll Island. I mean, it lays it all. And there's just numerous other ones about the creation of the Fed. And by the way, it was 1913, not 1910, as I recall. Although it's conceivable I'm wrong, I often am, but I don't think so in this case. James in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, James, listening to KPTK. What's up?
Tom, it's good to hear that you're not hitting the cough button so often.
Yeah, I'm feeling considerably better. It's the wonders of doxycycline and high-potency garlic pills.
Fantastic. We're liking it out here.
Yeah.
Hey, the guy that called earlier about PTSD with John McCain and not understanding.
Yeah.
I'd like to see people bone up on the Stockholm Syndrome. the Stockholm syndrome from birth, like with Patty Hearst,
mm-hmm.
to where they take over their captor's belief system.
Yeah.
All the way from birth, all the way up with John McCain, through the church, through the military service.
So that's that. You think that that entire mindset of McCain's is a variation on the Stockholm syndrome? That's an interesting hypothesis, James, and it makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, there is that mentality that runs through some families, I suppose. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Before the hour, you know, we were talking about John McCain's warrior nature. Let's just remember a time in America when we understood how destructive war was. This President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
Yeah, and wasn't that a glorious time? I mean, you know, when America actually was America and actually held to American values, and instead, now we've got our Rush Alert for the day.
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am,
because I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
Yes. So, Rush is explaining Barack Obama coming out and saying, well, you know, Hillary can stay in the race as long as she wants. It's entirely appropriate that Hillary's in the race. So, nothing wrong with Hillary being in the race. And so Rush then translates that for us.
In closing, let me
Hang on just a minute. Push the wrong button.
Can I translate that for you? I don't know why the B.I. itch is staying in. I feel like a damn hostage here. But I can't say it because she's a woman. And if I say that, they're going to jump down in my throat for being a sexist.
Mm-hmm. So you're not a sexist, eh, Rush? The guy who ran the ad.
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes? And you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox.
Yes, you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox from the Limbaugh show. And, of course, Limbaugh's opinion of where all this came from.
I have long told you. For example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
Yeah. So, I guess we'll just leave it at that. Scott in Orange County, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm good. I wanted to make comment on the term nation building and its use. I've heard it twice now in the last week. And
the phrase nation building.
Nation building in terms of the Iraq War. And I've read both the Naomi books, and, you know, but they're very enlightening and, frankly, frightening, because this is anything but nation building. It's all for their own self-interest, and plain and simple. And I want to keep that out there.
What we're building is Halliburton and Bechtel, and we're building some of these huge corporations. I mean, Halliburton's stock has tripled since Bush came into office. No, good point, Scott, and well made. Iraq already built Iraq, thank you very much, and they did a fine job. And the average Iraqi salary is about $500 a year, and if we simply paid Iraqis to rebuild Iraq, they could do it all over again, too! But we got to pay Halliburton $500,000 per person per year to do it instead, just because they make good contributions to the Republican Party. Richard, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
I talk about John McCain.
Yeah.
I've been talking about this with my friends and family about him for some time now, why he favors war and stuff. And I agree with your other listeners, because he's never seen the real carnage of war. He caused the carnage, but he never saw it. He was bombing people from 30,000 feet and then going flying back to his aircraft carrier and have a nice warm bunk to sleep in.
Yeah, well, it may be true, Richard. I don't know. I don't want to try and psychoanalyze John McCain. I mean, speaking as a guy who is on the Vermont roster of psychotherapists, as a psychotherapist, I'm reluctant to psychoanalyze him. But I do remember, I don't remember this presidential election because I was just born when it happened, but I do remember Eisenhower's presidency. And this is the ad that Dwight Eisenhower successfully ran for president on in the election of 1952.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
You get that? Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. Let me just play it. This was the supreme Allied commander in Europe, the guy who led the invasions of Europe, a man who saw far more death and destruction than anybody should ever have to in their lives.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
There you go. And he actually understood it. Let's see here. Joe in Lafayette, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, I was hearing some of the comments about McCain, and I like to call you more prepared, but I'm going to do my best here. Peter B. Collins has subbed in for you a couple times, has he not?
Yeah, he has, and he's a good friend.
Heard someone on his show last night. It comes on very late at night in my market on Green 960, so it's three quarters of the way asleep. Guy's name might have been Dr. Paul Butler, but I'm not sure about that name. He was at the Naval Academy with John McCain. He was actually imprisoned in Hanoi for 2 years longer than McCain was. And he simply spent the half hour on the show last night regaling the audience with all sorts of stories about McCain, you know, his legendary temper, which I think people know about. You know, when they were on the same floor in the barracks of the academy, McCain's roommate would sometimes have to leave the room and sleep someplace else when McCain was throwing it at.
Yeah, it could be. It's got nothing to do with post-traumatic stress disorder. It could just be that he has, by temperament, a very volatile personality and a sense of, you know, entitlement. He's the kid of the son of the big shot and all that kind of thing. Sort of like George W. Bush. I mean, you know, it's
very Bush-like in that way. He would never have graduated from the academy, apparently, with his, but for having people in the military.
Yeah, if it wasn't for his dad. Yep. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Hey, coming up tomorrow, Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation. Are radical atheists as potentially dangerous as radical right-wing evangelicals? Plus, former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura drops by to talk about politics. Is he going to be on the ballot this fall? And his new books, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.